This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Great Schools President Matthew Nelson. He will tell us about Great Schools' latest first of its kind report that recognizes and celebrates high schools that excel in ensuring students are ready for college based on some school-level post-secondary data that they have gathered by state. And there are 5 Northwest Indiana schools on the Indiana list. We'll find out more about that. A little later, we'll have another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University for you. And we'll also have Meg DeMakis, who represents the Family Folklore Foundation. They're helping put together an effort to celebrate the 125th anniversary of the Memorial Opera House in Valparaiso with a radio play and a puppet show. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. An organization called Great Schools has put out the first-of-its-kind report that recognizes and celebrates high schools all across the country that excel in making sure that the students at those schools are prepared for college. And we'll find out more about this very special report from an organization called Great Schools, from the president of Great Schools. Matthew Nelson is with us. Matthew, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, if you will tell us a little bit. Well, thank you. Good afternoon to you. Tell us a little bit first about Great Schools, and then, if you will, tell us more about the College Success Awards.
Great Schools is a nonprofit organization that really focuses on providing information to parents to help them support their kids' learning. And we are primarily a website that parents can go to, and they can find out information about schools in their community. They can also find out all kinds of information to help them support their kids' learning at home and at school. One of the things that we're doing is, you mentioned the College Success Award. We are bringing attention to schools that are doing an exceptional job preparing their students for life beyond high school to enter college and prepared to undertake college-level studies and to stick with college. And so in Indiana, we've actually found 45 schools that are doing a very good job. That represents about 11% of the high schools in the state.
That's great. I also know, too, and looking at the list of the 45 schools in Indiana, that there are 5 from Northwest Indiana, and they are Chesterton Senior High School in Chesterton, Hanover Central High School, which is located here in Lake County in Cedar Lake, Munster High School in Munster, Valparaiso High School in Valparaiso, and in the Porter County, Wheeler High School, which is, of course, near Valparaiso. First, let me ask, since you've explained a little bit about what the College Success Award is all about, let's talk about the data that you and your colleagues there at Great Schools had to go through. And an awful lot of it seems like, as you're talking about more than 800 high schools around the country, and we're talking not only public schools, but charter schools as well. In going through the data, what did you use to determine which criteria these particular schools met so they in turn could get the College Success Award?
Right. But we're looking primarily at 3 high-level factors. So one is college preparation, mm-hmm. which, some good indicators there would be high school graduation, entrance exam performance, and participation rates. We're also looking at college enrollment. So are kids actually enrolling in college? And then the third factor is performance in college. And there we're looking at are kids prepared as measured by remediation? There are some kids, when they enter college, they're really not ready for college-level work, and so they have to take what's called remedial courses. And then we're also looking at kids coming back for a second year of college. And all of this has been made available by the State of Indiana Department of Education. Mm-hmm. And I really would commend them for making this information available, because it's not required. A lot of education information is mandated by federal requirements. And the State of Indiana has gone above and beyond that has enabled us to capture this information about Indiana high schools and really use it to find the schools that are doing a fantastic job and to help celebrate those schools and then also learn from them.
I also know, too, that Indiana is among just only a handful of states in the Midwest that have participated in this. And not even the state of Illinois has. But I suppose maybe in time they will kind of come on board. Is that the hope?
That is certainly part of our goal. Is we think that all states should be making this information mm-hmm. available. Because it really can be used to identify schools that deserve a lot of recognition, and also will help us in learning more what's working in those schools and how can we help replicate those practices.
Did you have any problems that you could tell, or you or your staffers, maybe I should say, in working with the Indiana Department of Education to sell them on this idea of this particular opportunity to show off Indiana high schools?
It's an interesting question. I'm not aware of any problems that we encountered. We mm-hmm. reached out to all states and asking for this information, telling them what we were going to be using it for. And as far as I know, it was a smooth process with the State Department.
I'm taking a look at the information that you folks have posted on your website here about Indiana, which we just mentioned earlier, 45 high schools, and we're talking a combination of public schools as well as charter schools in Indiana have picked up college success awards this year. Many of them are just average schools with average graduation rates of 96%. So we're not talking about super stellar schools, but one thing jumps to at least to my attention. There are four award-winning schools in the state that have more than 40% of the student body who qualify for free or reduced price meals. And particularly in going through the breakout here in Northwest Indiana, one school jumped out in particular that probably no one realized that might be on that list. And we're talking about Munster High School in a very affluent community of Munster here in Lake County. How did you folks, first off, come up with the idea of being able to put this in the criteria, and what may have turned out to be the case in Munster High School's case, why they happened to be included because of that particular category?
It's interesting. I'm looking at Munster's profile, which anybody, any of your listeners can go to greatschools.org and look up their high school and also Munster High School. I'm seeing that Munster High School may not be one of the four schools that you're mentioning. It looks like they have 17% of their student body qualifies for free and reduced lunch. What's really important about this is that we recognize that economics plays a role in kids' education, and that schools need to work extra hard when they're serving lower-income students. And so from our perspective, it was very noteworthy to highlight the schools that are doing an exceptional job with lower-income populations, and that there were four schools that we found in Indiana that really are deserving of accolades for their work in preparing kids for success in college.
One of the interesting things I know, too, in the information that came out about the 45 College Success Award-winning schools in Indiana was that an average of 63% of the students from the schools have done well enough that they've really, really toughed it out in their freshman year of college, which is, I suppose, probably the toughest that a student could go through at first, and they've made it onto their second year. They're now sophomores, and that has to be very good, which I understand in this particular case is well above average.
Yes, indeed. First year college is pretty tough. As a parent of a first year student at college right now, I know that firsthand. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that's really important to recognize about high schools is that they play an incredibly important role in not only giving kids the academic foundation to succeed, but some of the life skills like resiliency and the ability to stick it through. Even if things are tough. And so the schools that we're giving this award to certainly have shown that they've prepared students beyond academics to thrive beyond high school.
We're talking with Matthew Nelson, who is the president of an organization called Great Schools. And in fact, you can go on greatschools.org and take a look at the information we're talking about today. The first of its kind report is out, which is recognizing and celebrating high schools around the country. Of the big list, more than 800. And of those 800, 45 here in Indiana. And of that list of 45, five here in Northwest Indiana. We know that, these schools have, obviously, they've worked hard through their faculty and staff and the students, of course, themselves, with the gumption that they have in wanting to succeed in life, to be able to show that they can meet the challenge of being able to not only start college, but to continue on. And then this information that's on the website will go into great detail about that if you check it out. Have you had any response from any of the schools? Have they gotten any word back? Gotten word to them, I should say, of the College Success Awards and the fact that these schools have done very well?
We've been getting really good feedback from school leaders. There's a lot of excitement. Schools, the people, the adults within the school, and the students within school work so hard. Day in, day out. It's a long game for everybody involved, and to be able to get national recognition for their effort, I think, is very meaningful. We heard from one principal who said, this means the world to him and to his community because they work so hard. Overall, the feedback has been super positive. The other thing that the award is doing is calling attention to specific educational practices, which I just think is really important to recognize what the award-winning schools are actually doing, what some of the common practices are that set kids up for success. One quick example would be the real importance of providing access for all students to rigorous academic offerings, both in school and through extracurricular programs.
I was going to ask you if there's anything in particular, and you've just answered my question. Thank you about what these schools particularly seem to like in their curriculum obviously have made some success of that because so many students at their particular schools have done well enough to be able to earn that particular school a College Success Award for this year. Are there any things in particular that you've all have discovered there at Great Schools to be able to pass along to the schools that participate in the program that these are ideas, if they haven't already put them into effect in their curriculum or in their practices in a particular school, that in turn will help the students succeed maybe more so than they might otherwise when they go on to college?
Yeah, I think every school is unique, and so we find different combinations of practices that really work for them. But another theme that we saw was that virtually all of the high schools that we studied, both the award-winning schools and all the other schools in the nine states where we've collected this information, but virtually all of the schools have programs for identifying and supporting at-risk students in the first year of high school. But one thing that really distinguished the award winners from the other schools was that they have programs to continue identifying and supporting and intervening with at-risk students all the way through high school up until 12th grade. It's just important to acknowledge that adolescence is a really amazing time for young people. It's also filled with some challenges, and that the more that high schools can do to keep their eyes on the students and really getting to know the students and develop personal relationships and not let them slip through the cracks, the more successful students will be in the long run. As one principal in Kentucky put it, students in high school are not just attending high school, they're defining their futures. And I just think it's really important to look at the incredible role that high school plays as building a foundation for the future success of students, not just in college, but in life and career beyond high school.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and if you would probably expound on a little here, is the fact that we note that by 2020 there will be so many jobs in our country of some type or another that are going to require some kind of post-secondary education, more than what the high school graduates are certainly getting now. And do you think that's the mandate that schools need to follow for the future? than whether they're private schools or charter schools or whether they're public high schools?
I think that's an important consideration. I think it opens up a future of opportunities to have a college degree. We also know that the vast majority of parents want their children to have the opportunity to attend college. The reality is not everybody goes to college, and there are plenty of examples of people who are successful without going to college. But underlying all of that, what we do see is that there's a strong association between being prepared to go to college and success later in life, whether you go to college or not. And so really engaging in high school, in the academic study and the all the other benefits of high school to really create a foundation for future success is so important.
Well, Matthew Nelson, thank you to you and everybody that you work with at Great Schools for putting all the work in getting the data together, and in particular here in Indiana, and of course the benefit that Northwest Indiana faces in this too, in being able to put out this very first time the College Success Awards, 45 Indiana schools, and as we mentioned earlier, that some of those, including Northwest Indiana schools, are in turn receiving these awards for the efforts and recognition that they deserve for getting their students ready to get into and to succeed in college. And Matthew, thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
And Chris, congratulations to all the schools in Northwest Indiana and throughout the state on this award. It's really impressive, and thanks for having me on your show.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties between within and across our communities.
Anybody that I've ever talked to about Gary has the same view that I do, that it's a total lost cause. Nothing can be done to turn Gary around. So it's hopeless. And why is that so? Well, probably at its zenith, Gary had maybe 175,000 people in it. But keep in mind, during that time, U.S. Steel, not just U.S. Steel, Gary Works, which employed over 20,000 people. You had Inland Steel Mill, you had Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company, you had Bethlehem Steel, you had all these steel companies that would support, you know, a town of that size. But as steel making, it not only got better, steel is not only made better now, it's made incredibly more efficiently. They used to make steel by melting. It would come out of the blast furnace as iron. They would cook it in these Bessemer ovens with scrap metal and produce steel, which they would pour in these molds. They'd let the molds cool. Then they'd pull the molds off. Then they'd have to take them over to another place, reheat them, and then roll them into slabs, and then from there roll them into coils that went to make refrigerator doors and things like this. Now, they make a heat of steel in about 30 minutes. So, Gary's, what are you gonna do with Gary? And what a shame, because if I ever drive you through that city, man, that place is laid out beautifully. It's a perfect north, south, east, west grid. The streets are, you know, it's States on the east side of Broadway, Presidents on the west, goes from 2nd Avenue to 54th Avenue. Perfect. And I suppose if you could just take bulldozers and knock down all the houses, you could make something out of it. Certainly there's a lot of vacant property in Gary. Tax base is super low. I can't imagine why some forward-thinking company wouldn't want to do something like that. Why wouldn't you just build a Saturn auto plant down on 11th and Grant Street, where the old Anderson windshield wiper company used to be? It'd be a perfect greenfield site to just demolish and put a huge industrial complex in there. But nobody wants to stick their foot in the water. Oh, that feels pretty good. Okay, let's build a big house here. No, they're not going to do it. Like, let's just say you could buy a whole block, my old street, for some minimal amount of money. Okay, so now I'm going to erect a nice house there. Well, there's got to be somebody else to do the same thing, or else I'm just going to be a nice house out in the middle of nowhere. And this takes time to develop a whole new neighborhood. I just think people look at it and say, there's plenty of farmland in Valparaiso for sale. Hebron, Wheatfield, Couts. I'm not going over there.
You can find more original stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. An organization known as the Family Folklore Players is back in life here in Northwest Indiana. We've had a conversation before with Megan Makis about this and other things, but in particular about this particular group that likes to put on combinations of radio plays and puppet plays. Well, another one's coming up, and this time it's in celebration of the 125th anniversary of the Memorial Opera House in Valparaiso. And Megan's with us to talk about this next performance coming up. Thanks for joining us today, Meg.
Well, thank you for having us.
Well, this is going to be a very special event, as these others have too, and in particular with this one because of the importance of the celebration coming up here. Tell us what this next performance is going to be all about on May 17th.
Okay, we're in conjunction with the Memorial House's jubilee of 125 years, and the mission of Family Folklore Foundation is to offer learning experiences to people of all ages, and then what we learn, we share it with the greater public. And so when I found out about this jubilee, what we did is we set about learning about things that have happened since for the last 125 years. We backed it up, and we're starting with Abe Lincoln. And we focus mainly on Northwest Indiana, so we were back in the dunes, and we have people who are representing heroes that helped make the dunes, and then we have a puppet play that is more developed than the last one, and it has more flora and fauna of the dunes. We're having a lot of fun with the Opera House because it's got the balconies, and we actually have hecklers in the puppet play, kind of like in the Muppet Show.
Oh, really?
And they're in the balcony.
Oh, really? Okay.
We're excited because this is the first time we're going to be at the Opera House where they actually have the lights and the sound. And Stretch, who's the tech guy, he's helping it be very professional.
Mm-hmm. Now, this performance, as we mentioned, is going to be on May 17th. And there is basically only one performance left because I guess the first one, the one that's at, 10:30 in the morning, I think, on that day, has already sold out. But they still have plenty of tickets for the second, I understand.
Yes. Well, what we did was Becky Swerden, who's another very active member of the group. We have about 50 people in our group. We used to teach elementary. And so I know that state history is taught to fourth graders. And so we emailed and sent out postcards to all the fourth grade teachers in five school systems. Mm-hmm. And that's how we filled up the 10:30.
Wow.
The 12:30 is kind of at their lunchtime. So, but this is a performance where it's very informative, and it's great for seniors, and it's great for mothers, homeschoolers. We even offer a take-home package, which is a booklet that reviews everything that's taught, and the last page, it has a contest where you can make your own time capsule, time machine, or talk about how you're going to use your life work to improve the world. And the prize is you get to be in one of our activities.
That's great.
Yeah.
What came gave you all the idea of using the concept of a radio play along with the puppets to help tell the story?
Well, when we had our first things that we did where we studied downtown Valpo, we studied the actual Opera House, the Jail Museum, and the Genealogy Department, and mm-hmm. we create magazines. So we had all the students from South Haven, the fourth graders. This was back in 2009. We had them make a video. They made a booklet. They did research, and I told the teachers they had to send. They got three pages, and there was a deadline. So they all felt like journalists. And then we did rent the Opera House, but when the people stood up and talked about what they learned, it wasn't that exciting,
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we thought, why not a radio play? And then it evolved to, why not a puppet show? But we're open to anything, and we're open to any kind of a project. We do individual things. We had somebody who had a big collection of quilts, and so we just used our cell phones. We recorded their voices talking about each quilt, took pictures of each quilt, and made it into a book. And we're working with somebody else who has embroidery that is from her grandma. And so, you know, and so small projects, big projects. We're going to be helping a little bit in Miller on a project about bikes, having kids learn how to do bikes. We're working a little bit with Discovery School where they do Earth Force. Whatever's interesting, you know, it's a 501c3, and we're interested in as many projects as we want. And that's why we just joined the Valpo Chamber.
Once again, this project is coming up for the public to see on May 17th, and there is a 12:30 p.m. performance.
And it's only $5.
$5 to attend, and that's going to be held at the Memorial Opera House. In fact, this whole is a project to help support and honor the 125th anniversary of the Memorial Opera House in Valparaiso.
And, you know, we have the South Shore Brass Band Quintet, and they are playing Cole Porter, Hoagy Carmichael. We're going to be doing a sing-along of the Indiana State song and things.
Meg Domenkus, thank you for being with us to talk about this, and we hope a lot of people come over for the 12:30 performance on the 17th.
Thank you for having us.
Diversity on police department is just as important as anything else in trying to be able to have a good rapport with the public, and police officers are learning that more and more every day as we have more incidences like the ones that we've experienced in Ferguson, as well as in New York City and Baltimore and other bigger cities. These problems don't want to happen in Northwest Indiana, and there are ways that you can keep from that happening by the proper training, and in turn, that comes with, of course, starting at, I guess, what you could consider as police academy or something like it. And we have with us to talk about, at least as far as the community of Griffith is concerned, Police Chief Greg Mance with us. Chief Mance, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's very important that the police officers, of course, get the proper training. Many of them come in with some experience, I know, if they've been in the military, with military police and related training. Maybe they've had training with some other police department, but everybody kind of starts from scratch, don't they? And especially these days when it's so important to be trained properly. Tell us what experiences that you've encountered as being the police chief with Griffith and how you hope that maybe with the next round of police candidate training that might get improved or get changed.
Yes, be a pleasure. I came to Griffith PD in 1999 as a patrol officer, tested. I was fortunate enough to get hired by the very first department I applied with. That's kind of a unique experience. Eventually, I worked my way through the department in various ranks and positions, and in 2013, I became the police chief. And almost immediately upon becoming chief, I was tasked with the responsibility of doing a hiring process. And in that process, I found I used the same system that other chiefs prior to me had used, and I had the same response that they had. I had relatively small interest in the application process. I think I had 63 people apply, and of those that applied, very few were females or minorities. And during the testing process, I found that many were not qualified, not prepared to take the very unique test that we do that's mandated by state for entry into law enforcement. And when you have very small numbers of females or minorities in that process, you know, just by statistics, they're going to get dropped from the process because there's so few of them.
Yeah.
So the next cycle that I had, it was 2015, so I wanted to try a different approach. So I enlisted some help from some friends that I had. Dr. Ellen Jarletta, the director of Indiana University Northwest Center for Urban Regional Excellence, was a former professor of mine. I reached out to her and Dr. Ferrandino, another professor at IUN, as well as some representatives from Crossroads YMCA, mainly Carlos Brigham, the executive director, and Sharon Bowling, the wellness director. And I met with them trying to come up with a police candidate training program where we could, of those people who are interested, whether they, you know, be white, black, Hispanic, female, anyone could come take this practice session where they would learn, have a better idea of what to expect when they came for the physical portion of the test, the oral interviews, and the written test. And the idea was just to get everyone to show that Griffith PD was really ambitious about helping these candidates succeed, and that we were very aggressive in our efforts to recruit minorities and females and to make the playing field very level. So even if you'd never applied for a department before, you might have the same skill or knowledge of that testing process as someone who's gone to two or three prior.
If you will, take a few moments and explain to us, you kind of alluded to it at the beginning of our conversation about the fact that maybe this exam to be able to become a police officer statewide is not just the town of Griffith, but statewide is so difficult, in particular for minorities and for females. What is it about the test that you're hoping that with this help you'll be able to overcome the barriers of getting more women and more minorities in as police officers?
I mean, the biggest issue that we have regionally, and I think nationwide, is there's not a lot of interest or perceived interest by females and minorities to get into the profession of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we've have to work on. It's not going to be fixed overnight. And then when you have a testing process that is somewhat unique, you have these females and minorities that apply for these jobs, and they get discouraged, and they might not apply again. And the test, the written test, is unique. It's not just a multiple choice test. If you haven't taken a test in a while, it's a little bit challenging. If you've never taken a law enforcement type of test, it's even more challenging. So What this workshop does is it kind of prepares people for just general test-taking tips, as well as give them an idea of some of the questions they might be asked. Yeah, for instance, there's questions about, there'll be a map illustration. It'll ask the applicant to navigate the quickest route to a certain area on that map. So again, it's not a test you would have taken in high school, but it's a test that you're likely going to be tested on for a police exam.
I would imagine, too, that probably there are, of course, questions on the exam as well, too, that deal with psychological issues, analysis, maybe a situation an officer has to come up upon, and dealing with people at the scene of an incident of some kind, whether it's a crime or whether it's just an accident or something even simple as that.
Yes, it's a very all-encompassing test.
Yeah.
Tries to measure of what the applicant, how they might perform if they were in fact hired.
Mm-hmm. And I know too that as you mentioned before about the fact that the physical exam is very strenuous. In working with the folks at IU Northwest as well as the Crossroads YMCA, and in coming up with this way to help female and minority police candidates get through this, what kinds of ways on the physical end of the exam do you to help them out?
So what the YMCA did was they looked at the actual physical exam that these departments are mandated to give by the state.
Mm-hmm.
And when the applicants come in with this police candidate training program, we actually show them the test. This is what you're going to be required to do. So you're going to be required to do so many sit-ups within a minute, so many push-ups within a minute. You have to run a certain distance in this time frame. You have to jump within a certain height just with a vertical jump. So what the YMCA does is they have some trainers there, and we also bring in some officers from region-wide departments that do this type of training, and they actually act as coaches for the applicants. So the applicants get an opportunity to run through the tests they're going to be required to take when they apply for a department, and then if they fall short of what they need to pass to go on to the next process, the YMCA and the officers give them coaching tips on how they can better prepare themselves. We often find that some females lack the upper body strength to do the required number of push-ups. So they're able to give adequate coaching so they can prepare themselves. So when they do take that test in a month or two or 6 months down the road, they're at a much better advantage to pass that test.
Did that seem to help, I guess, if an applicant comes in and maybe they don't pass the test the first time around because of physical limitations of some type, that this is the right kind of training, right kind of conditioning that will help them try again, and the second time around they'll make it in?
Yes. Fortunately, we launched this program in 2015. Based upon that, we hired our second female in the department's 115-year history.
Mm-hmm.
She was a former Olympian, someone that was in great physical shape. But because of the sport that she was in, she still had some areas where she could improve upon. And just in speaking with her, it was the guidance that she received through our police candidate training program that helped her succeed in passing that physical portion of her test, and she was ultimately hired. So, we've had some early success in this workshop. We hired a female that might not have made it through our process. She's very qualified and very skilled. We're happy to have her. And I think this process might have, helped her along with that process.
I was going to say, too, that probably for her standpoint, too, it probably makes her feel more confident. And she makes not only a better police officer, but more comfortable in staying with the force and some longevity there, too, rather than deciding that I'm going to try this for a while and have to drop out.
Yeah, no, one of the things that, I think not only my department, but any department that does a process like this, it's showing your candidates and your applicants that you're there to make them succeed. You're there to offer them every tool possible for them to succeed. And with that, you will have some buy-in to the department and some longevity.
That's right. Well, Chris, all that longevity, I guess, goes back to the proper training, and that's what this is all about, being able to be a good candidate service as a police officer in the town of Griffith or any place, I suppose, in Northwest Indiana. And that's where the police candidate training comes in here. Give us some of the particulars about the next sessions coming up.
Yeah, again, so it's the Griffith Police Department, the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence, and the Crossroads YMCA have all joined up to sponsor this event. It'll be Saturday, May 19th at Indiana University Northwest from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Anyone who's interested in applying for a position with any local law enforcement agency is encouraged to apply. It doesn't have to be just Griffith. If you've got an interest in working for the Sheriff's Department or even the railroad police, you're likely going to have to take a very similar type of test. And this workshop will provide you with the useful tips and techniques to help the applicants advance in the hiring process.
Well, Chief Manz, it sounds like that this will be a great opportunity for people who are truly interested in becoming a member of law enforcement in Northwest Indiana, as well as just the community of Griffith alone, but to learn more and to be able to be properly, I guess, acclimated and in turn be conditioned to know what it's going to be like when you go to the training as a police officer, to be sure. And it sounds like a lot of people, I think, have had the interest and they're going to sign up, and we'll probably have a full class or so come the session coming up in May.
I think we will. I'm very hopeful of that. If the application process will open April 1st and run through May 16th, anyone who's interested can register at griffithymca.org.
Griffith Police Chief Greg Manz, thanks very much for being with us to talk about this today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Police Chief Greg Manz with the community of Griffith. The next round of police candidate training is going to be underway, involving the IU Northwest Center for Regional Excellence, as well as the Crossroads YMCA. The workshops will be underway with the next training of police candidates. The Republican Party primary for Indiana's U.S. Senate race features three candidates vying to challenge incumbent Democrat Joe Donnelly. Jasper businessman Mike Braun is one of them. Braun, who's built his auto parts distribution business into a multi-million dollar enterprise, is also a former state representative. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith sat down with Braun recently to talk about the issues in a race that has been billed by some political observers as the nastiest in the nation.
Now, you talk about these crises and downturns that you've lived through in your businesses and in your life. Some Hoosier farmers are a little worried about the next one around the corner with the trade war with China, with the tariffs. Indiana would be hit harder than most states in the nation because of that. Are you worried those farmers are going to take their anger out on someone who's aligning themselves with President Trump?
If, in fact, there is retaliation in a significant way as a result of holding China accountable. I think, Trump resonated in this state because we're all for free and reciprocal trade. And I think we're seeing already where this is going to lead to at least addressing it and not kicking it down the road or sweeping it under the rug. I think that in this particular case, his goal was to start the conversation. I feel real good about his leadership and where he's going to go with this.
But if China retaliates?
That's if, and it's hypothetical, and I trust President Trump and his group of advisors to make the right calls there. I don't think his goal is to start a trade war. His goal is to bring this conversation to the table. And I think so far he's done it about right.
Supporting Donald Trump the person, are you worried about tying yourself that closely to someone who could go off book?
No, because I was inspired when he ran. If he had not made it through the gautlet of outmaneuvering all the establishment politicians, we'd have more of the same. And we'd have all the problems that have built up over 20 to 30 years. Hoosiers liked him when he ran, and like him now, if not better, because he represents something different.
Do you think you'd feel comfortable criticizing Donald Trump for a decision while still saying you support him?
If it was on the policy or the substance, I'm going to speak my own mind like I intend to do.
Now, you talked about you came to the State House to be a state rep in part because your constituent, you saw that the infrastructure was lacking and terrible. At the end of the day, you did vote for a tax increase. Why should voters be okay with that?
And that's something you need to answer. First of all, it was something that all Hoosiers wanted, and they're happy for it. Because now, if you've been driving around the state like I have, all across the state, the potholes are still there. Thank goodness we've got this in place to start repairing the roads and then do some of the projects that we need to complete, like the last leg of 69.
But when you're talking to a voter, isn't it easier for a voter to hear, well, he raised taxes, as opposed to, well, he raised taxes, but for all these reasons?
I think voters are smarter than that, and if they're driving our roads, they're going to know it. I think a guy like Todd Rokita, who is on record saying states ought to take this responsibility of raising their gas taxes. That's what I'd be concerned about, is somebody that says something like that and then has the gall to, you know, bring this up as a campaign issue.
You did vote in Democratic primaries for a couple of decades. Yeah. Should Republicans trust that you are a lifelong Republican?
I'm a lifelong Republican and a conservative one, and that shows a lack of knowledge about Indiana politics. If you grew up in any county, basically south of Indy and south of Bloomington for sure, it's culturally and fiscally more conservative than most places in the middle of the state that have been legacy Republican counties.
Are you worried that the bruising nature of this primary is just feeding into Joe Donnelly?
I think only when it comes to the two of them. For me, I've pretty well just said all three of my opponents are career politicians.
If either Messer or Rokita were to come out the winner, would you feel comfortable supporting them against Joe Donnelly?
I'm going to be behind the conservative candidate that is a Republican winner, sure.
Thanks so much for sitting down with me.
You're welcome.
Some big changes coming to the Green Sense Farms in Porter County that you might be aware of. They're going to convert the farm basically to not only a farm, and we'll find out more about that in a moment, but also the fact that it's going to be a full-fledged research and development farm. And to tell us more about it, we have the founding farmer and CEO of Green Sense Farms, Robert Colangelo, with us. Robert, thanks for joining us here in Ridgely Speaking.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with Green Sense Farms over in the Portage area, tell us how the farm got started and the very interesting and rather innovative way that you're learning how to grow plants.
Well, we have a transformative way to grow produce indoors 365 days a year without the use of pesticides or GMOs. And we started our farm in 2012 here in Portage. And since then, we've learned a lot. One of the things we learned is that we're at the beginning of the beginning of a brand new industry, mm-hmm. which requires lots of research and development to keep our technology current and to allow us to grow year-round and always be locally grown.
One of the interesting things that I've learned here about Green Sense Farms is the rather innovative way that you have come up with an indoor vertical growing system. Will you please explain how this really works and how it's become so productive in creating produce that people can enjoy year-round now?
The simple answer is we took horizontal farming, which has been done for thousands of years in a field farm outdoor, and we brought it inside and we stacked it. So we grow in hydroponic tubs where we interject the nutrient in the water into a plant's root system. So we give them exactly what they need, the right amount of fertilizer, the right amount of nutrients, the right amount of light, and also we control the environment so that the temperature and humidity and CO2 are perfect for the plants to go through the photosynthesis process. And by doing this, it allows us to grow year-round regardless of weather and outside climate.
Not a unique concept, but the way that you're doing it certainly is. I know that you've been able to expand Green Sense Farms from just the operation in Portage here in Indiana to near South Bend, and you've got some other locations too, and I imagine it's all part and parcel of being able to find ways to grow plants, even though indoors, in different kinds of climates.
Yes. The trick is to create one environment that's good for the plants and then be able to build these farms around the world regardless of the outside climate. So we are building a farm in Las Vegas where it's very hot and dry. We're also building a farm in French Polynesia where it's very hot and humid, and also one in South Bend where you get hot summers and very cold winters. So regardless of the outside temperature and climate, we can still grow consistently year-round because we control the indoor climate.
Now, Robert, what do you hope to take in making this conversion of just from the regular farm that you've set up here at the Green Sense Farms in Portage into a full-fledged research and development operation? What's it take to make the transition from one type of farm to basically another?
When we started this farm, we were doing both commercial production as well as doing R&D on systems and on the cultivars or the varieties of plants we can grow. By stopping our commercial production, we can now focus on testing new systems, such as different LED lights, both intensity and frequency. We can also test climate control systems that measure and monitor our temperature and our humidity. We can also test automated sensors and automation control devices, as well as automated packaging and conveyance equipment. On the other side, we're constantly improving our growing process, being able to get a higher density of plant per square foot and more plants per level, and turning our towers more often per month. So working on all those variables is what the center is going to be turned into. It was very difficult to grow for commercial production and sales and do R&D. We weren't doing either very well. Now we can have it very focused on R&D.
Yeah, it sounds like that you really have to devote space and time and effort from one or the other, and you can't, seemingly, as you've discovered, you can't do both at the same time, and you do justice to everything, I suppose. So it's probably well worth the time to convert over and be able to rely on the farms that you've set up, and in turn showing those as examples to the rest of the world that these are the ways that you can help grow plants indoors and vegetable produce indoors and do it economically as well as agronomically. So it works out very well, I would imagine, to do this. And then you can spend your time on research and development here in Portage.
Yes, and we're very lucky. We're working very closely with Purdue, Dr. Terry Mitchell and Hazel Weinstein, who runs the horticultural college there. They have been tied into a NASA grant to be working on different aspects of growing for the Mars and the lunar grow modules. And also, the indoor vertical farming industry has grown a lot since we were one of the first early adopters of this technology. And last year, over $1.6 billion has been raised to fund indoor vertical farm startups. So Our competitive advantage is being able to always develop the best growing technologies and then work on new cultivars that we can grow indoors at high densities. And so for us to remain competitive, we have to constantly raise technology, raise capital, and improve our technology.
Now, I know that since you worked so hard to be able to get the process started to begin with, you've been able to expand it from Portage into these other farms, including South Bend, and what you have set up that you're getting going on, I guess, in the South Pacific as well as in Las Vegas. You mentioned, too, that I guess you're trying to branch out around the world. There's many other countries that would, I'm sure, be interested or have looked at this. And I also understand, too, from your staff have told me that you've had an opportunity to take this up to some folks who are very interested in this operation from overseas. In fact, you had a recent visitor to Green Sense Farms there in Portage, I understand, to find out more about this and to talk with them about this.
Yes, our goal is to build a network of indoor vertical farms at our customer's location here in the U.S. and build a produce brand that's nationally known and locally grown through a network of farms that we build, own, and operate here in the USA. And then we license our technology to third parties to run farms that they own abroad. So we've had recent visitors from the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Our farms, we can build high-yield farms on a small footprint that use a lot less water, a lot less land, and a lot less fertilizer than greenhouses or field farms. And with the Middle East tight on water, our technology really works well out there.
Well, it certainly sounds that way, that it's a great opportunity to expand this idea into some very workable operations in other countries, too. So it sounds like you've gotten the interest of people overseas. That's the important thing, that it gets to expand from beyond the United States to go around the world, to be sure. And the other thing I was going to ask for sure is, since you've been working on this expansion to the point that you're trying to convert the GreenSense Farms operation in Portage over to this full-time research and development facility, do you have any kind of timetable for this? Is it an ongoing process you're going through now?
We've already started the conversion. And the other thing is that we've noted that most of the R&D facilities are at universities, and they're very small scale.
Right.
So it's very hard to extrapolate the data that's generated from these academic laboratories to production use. So we found that we have a great opportunity to do contract R&D for third parties, both testing systems as well as testing new plants out there. So we've begun that process, and we're very happy with what we're able to do with our current facility.
Well, you know, it sounds like this is a great opportunity to kind of go full circle. You say that you got the assistance from the horticulturists at Purdue University on the West Lafayette campus to get started in this project, and now you're going to be able to do more R&D and be able to help turn some back over to Purdue. I imagine they'll welcome that as well, too.
Yes. Purdue is a great university. They recently launched the Foundry, which is really geared to entrepreneurs, and I think in the last 18 months, they've launched over 150 startups. So with Mitch Daniels, now president at Purdue University, has done just a great job at trying to commercialize technologies and foster entrepreneurialism. And I really want to give a big shout out to our staff. We've got a great group of people here that are passionate and dedicated to figuring out how to grow more sustainably. And also the state of Indiana has really made great strides, being an agricultural state, to try to make Indiana the hub for biopharmaceutical research. And that's really our end goal, is to look at cultivars that we can grow, especially botanicals, that can be converted into medicines or vaccines. Because we think growing indoors is very precision growing, and its highest and best use is for vegetables, but making medicines could not be another excellent application.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robert, consider the shout-out completed. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about it.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and I commend you on getting great information through the Lakeshore Public Radio.
Robert Colangelo is the CEO, and he's the founding farmer of GreenSense Farms in Portage, Indiana. And the Portage farm is now making a transition from just being a farm to a state-of-the-art research and development center on its indoor vertical growing systems and testing some new cultivars as well. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow when we have in studio Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman.